Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 508 with my guest, Dr. Eric Wan. I am Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit bouncing around our heads. The show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. MentalPod, also the social media handles you can follow us at. Let's dive into it. Actually, I wanted to share something before we did this. I have the feeling this is probably kind of a universal thing, but I was playing hockey the other night, and somebody called me by the wrong name, and it felt like it bothered me more than it should. And I understand that this person, I've met them maybe once or twice, that they wouldn't know my name. I've done the same thing. But there's this kind of quasi painful, sad feeling that comes up in me when somebody calls me by the wrong name. And I think it's because it reminds me, oh, I'm just one of the billions. But there are times when feeling one of many is really connective, especially like when I'm in my support groups. But I don't know. I don't know why that bothers me so much. Or that it feels that way, because it's not that intense how it feels, but it feels like I should be able to have it roll off my back more than it does. And there's a little part of me, like when somebody knows my last name, that is surprised. It's so weird. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Shark Tooth. About his depression, he writes, "My depression is like walking around with a screw in my dick glued to my heel." That is quite an image. And I don't know if your dick is so long it reaches your heel, in which case I do not feel sorry for you. Actually, if somebody's dick was that big, I would feel sorry for them. About his ADHD, "It's like folding clothes in the shower while eating a sandwich before I'm late for therapy." But his anxiety, "It's like swimming with great white sharks with a pork chop around your neck." About his alcoholism and drug addiction, "Nothing is enough and everything is too much." Oh, that's so true. But his sex addiction, "It's like walking around a bakery starving and you can't buy any of the 27 different flavored donuts." Snapshot from his life. "Growing up, there was a good male friend of my parents who would come over to our house. Totally fucked up. He would kiss my mother on the mouth when he would visit and would skinny dip with my dad in our hot tub. He molested me from grade 8 all the way till I was 20. I never knew that it was wrong. I thought he was just loving me in this secret way. I told my girlfriend when I was drinking one night, and she told me to call my parents. I did, and they didn't believe me. My heart broke that day. I sued this man and have been sober for just over 2 years now. I used to do drugs and drink hard and use sex as a way to cope. Today I go to many support groups and try and heal the hole inside my soul. Buddy, I was... When I read that last part of your survey, I just wanted to drive to wherever you are and high-five you. That is, for people who haven't experienced sexual violation, especially multiple sexual violations, and then to not be believed by the people who are supposed to protect you, I mean, those are some serious, serious wounds. And the fact that you are taking care of yourself and healing and that you can smile is fucking amazing. Fucking amazing. We are sponsored today by the online therapy provider, BetterHelp.com. If you've never tried online therapy, why wouldn't you try it now? They have tons of great qualified therapists. Just go to our link, which is betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor that they think is a good fit, they'll match you up with one and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's a good fit for you. There's a huge range of expertise available, which often is not available for people locally. BetterHelp is available worldwide. Yeah. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. So again, go to betterhelp.com/mental. One more survey before we get to the interview with Dr. Juan. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Nan, and she writes, "As a CNA, I had a job caretaking a brain-injured woman. She had a binge eating issue, executive functioning issues, anxiety, and a lowered IQ. This woman ate way healthier than me and had her life more together than I did. I asked her about the eating disorder. I was supposed to keep an eye on and anxiety issues. She said, oh, I may eat an entire bag of cauliflower chips when I get overwhelmed, so I can only buy mini bags. Lady, I ate a gallon of ice cream last night and I had to take a Klonopin just to get in my car this morning. I think she should have been taking care of me.
Every little thing feels like the end of the world.
The darkness came so quickly.
I was so fucking angry.
Make me as close to dead as possible.
And I felt so powerless.
Without the commitment.
If there's a word for it,
unbearable.
It means somebody else felt this way.
The feeling is so intense.
It is a lot more work.
I was frightened all the time.
To feed a child's emotional world.
Everyone feels pain.
Than it is their superficial world.
Everyone suffers.
My sexual addiction was the shame.
My mom ended up killing that woman in front of me and my brothers.
I had to feel that shame in order to feel the pleasure.
And I was being a dick to everybody.
We are social beings.
And the only way you're going to get it out is to cry.
We need to be with people.
I grabbed them by their throats and led them down to the floor and watched the breath leave their bodies.
Maybe well, listen, thanks for coming in. I'm here with Dr. Eric Juan, who is a former Navy flight surgeon, but currently, you are working in the field of neuroscience and you're studying PTSD, traumatic brain injuries, depression. Thanks for coming on, first of all.
Yeah, it's absolutely an honor to be here with you.
So what kind of stuff are you discovering doing neuroscience research and how are you mapping the brain?
Yeah, so this is really an emerging space within medicine we call neuromodulation. And it's a form of brain stimulation. What we're doing a little bit differently is personalizing it to each individual. And the way we do that, and one of the more interesting components to this is using a brain mapping technology called quantitative EEG.
Is that where you put the electrodes all over the head?
That's exactly right. And yes. much like the way an EKG is an electrophysiologic picture of the brain, an EEG is an electrophysiologic picture, or I'm sorry, an EKG is an electrophysiologic picture of the heart, and EEG is an electrophysiologic picture of the brain. And we can glean quite a bit of information from these images. And just to explain a little bit about that, you know, most of the time in neuroscience, we think the gold standard in imaging is an MRI or a CT scan, but those are generally snapshots in time. They're still images, whereas an EEG, because it's taken over a time domain, it's kind of like a video, and we can see what is your brain doing over time? How are the different areas communicating with each other?
So are you seeing alpha and theta brain waves and stuff like that?
That's exactly right. And so it sounds like you're very well versed.
I did neurofeedback, I guess it would be called. I did many sessions, but my brain is stubborn, man. It's stubborn to meds. I've done transcranial magnetic stimulation, nothing from that. I've tried ketamine treatments. Yeah, my brain is a motherfucker. It is just, it does not participate. But the guy that did it, a great guy, works through UCLA and was, you know, just he was so curious about why my brain was just not responding. But for many people, they get a tremendous response from it. Talk about different brain waves, if you would.
Yeah. And so you mentioned two of them, alpha and theta, and those are two of the more intensely researched type of bands. There's also delta and beta, but what we're doing is we're primarily focused on alpha and theta, and there turns out to be stereotypical waveform patterns that emerge after doing thousands of these EEGs. And classically in depression, you see some slow wave activity in the prefrontal cortex, and specifically the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. This is the executive function area of the brain that organizes thoughts, planning, you know, emotional self-awareness, these kind of things. And if I can sort of lay out a picture, we all have a unique signature and a typical refresh rate somewhere between 8 and 13 hertz, which is your alpha band. And let's just say you are somebody who is an 11.4 hertz brain, which means you encode information 11.4 times per second. But if we see this waveform pattern of depression where there may be a cluster of neurons that are cycling at 2 hertz, because of that information mismatch, it may manifest as depression. You feel lethargic, don't want to get out of bed, and lack motivation. And where we differ a bit from the TMS you experience, TMS tends to be one location, one frequency. So it's that left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex area, and it's 10 hertz. And what we're doing is customizing to the individual. And so let's say rather than being in that area, your frequency and mismatch was the right occipital parietal lobe for whatever reason. If you, as a child, fell off ladder, hit the back of your head, and a cluster of neurons was stunned, and it just happened to be firing more slowly, we would geo-navigate to that specific area, and then we would find out what the cycle rate of your brain is, and we would tune to that area in hopes of trying to nudge those neurons back into a healthier state. And so classically, TMS will be fixed, and it's going to go after 10 hertz, because if you look at a population curve, most people are going to be right at around 10. But at either tail of a bell curve, whether you're a fast information processor who, let's say, it's an 11 or 12 hertz brain, or maybe a more creative person who's an 8 or 9 hertz brain, that 10 hertz stimulation may not be as effective as it could be if we treated based on your biological signal, what's unique to you.
I got you. So the picture of the brain you get, are you seeing all the parts of it? You mentioned the prefrontal cortex. Does it show you like a 2D image where you
Correct.
Can see what's
Yeah.
working and what's not?
That's exactly right. And so EEGs, they've been around for close to 100 years and in analog form, but they became digitized right around 2008. And that allowed us to do very sophisticated computational analytics. And we're now able to create 2D, 3D type images.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's enough spatial resolution where we can identify areas of the brain that may not be as coherent, meaning they're not communicating as well to other adjacent areas of cortical tissue as they otherwise could be.
Gotcha. Give me some success stories that you've had, whether it's depression or brain injury.
And so, you know, just with my background in the military, that ended up being something that I'm personally quite passionate about. And my first case was a veteran. He was a crew chief that I had deployed with. And he had the misfortune of witnessing one of his best friends die in combat. Over the next 12 to 13 years, struggled a bit and was doing everything his doctors and the VA was telling him to do. And unfortunately, ended up on between 18 to 20 medications a day and was struggling to read, struggling to sleep. And it was really one of those scenarios where it was the community that reached out to me and said, hey, can you do something to help him? And I'm going to leave his name out just for medical confidentiality. But I reached out to him. We had some long conversations. And, you know, as a friend, there was quite a bit of guilt because this was my buddy and I'd lost touch with him and I didn't know he was struggling like this. But we got him in to give the treatment a try. And this is at a point when I was very skeptical about the technology. And so it was just, let's see what it can do. I can't make any promises, but it may be worth a try because there's some promising data. And really within a week and a half to 2 weeks, he had a fairly significant transformation to the point where his wife came into the clinic in tears saying, this is my husband. You gave me my husband back. Wow. And, you know, he was engaged again. He would leave his room and, you know, he's started coaching his kids' football team. Sometimes you just see in somebody's eyes that something has changed. And with him, it was a fairly profound change. What I wasn't anticipating was that, so he went through about 2 months of treatment and about the 6 week mark, he gave me a call and said, hey doc, I'm off of all my medication. And, I stopped in my tracks and said, hey, that's actually a little bit dangerous. You shouldn't be doing that. Cause he was on opioids. And he said, well, you know, I just tapered myself down and I feel so much better when I'm off of these medications. And so to me, that was fairly compelling. And if it wasn't my friend, I may not have believed it. But, you know, I knew that this was not somebody who would candy coat things. If it wasn't working, he would certainly tell me. But he was having a wonderful response. And as I was vetting the technology, I brought in a second Marine and a third Marine, and they both had positive responses. And so, you know, there comes a point where you realize, okay, you know, there's something here. And, yeah. You know, we've embarked on many other really academically rigorous research trials and clinical studies. And while we're on the front end of a lot of that, we're seeing some promising data and results come back.
That's exciting. Talk about being a flight surgeon, if you would kind of, I don't know, maybe some snapshots from your experience there.
Sure. So being a flight surgeon, so I was a Navy flight surgeon. I was attached to a Marine Corps unit, HMM 268, and we were a medium lift squadron. And when we deployed, we were part of the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit, Special Operations Capable. We were supporting special operations in the Persian Gulf. And I look back at that time as some of my best years, just developed friendships that I'll have with me for life.
Can't imagine how deep they must be when you go through such intense experiences where you depend on each other.
Yeah, it's a unique thing where, you know, when you're going to another country that may not be particularly friendly to the U.S. and all you have is each other, and whether you're doing training or you're in, you know, live fire combat missions, it forges some very deep friendships and bonds. And I don't want to misrepresent anything. You know, as a doctor, I was always in the back and these guys were the heroes going out doing the great work. Just a tremendous honor to be a part of the mission. And, you know, I have the good fortune of being there, you know, during the times of crisis, or if something does go bad, to be able to try to help out in any way that I could. And so that bond kind of carries with you, even when you leave the service. And, you know, so we had, the first casualties of the Second Gulf War, And as a residue of that, a lot of post-traumatic stress. It was a very kinetic environment, so we had a good number of traumatic brain injuries. And even though I had left the service and finished up my medical training, my devotion and dedication to these guys really sort of strengthened. So I was always looking for what could be helpful. And, you know, this last weekend, I listened to a bunch of your podcasts, and it was refreshing to hear, you know, the openness to a lot of the evidence-based literature out there, because not everyone's aware of EMDR, or, you know, there may not be the kind of openness that there should be to different types of therapies, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical therapy, prolonged exposure. You know, there's more and more tools that are being added to the fight, and that you're covering these, I think, is a very important conversation to have. I think just the awareness is important. And, you know, we're trying to offer everything we could to our veterans during this window. And learning about this, I think the big advantages of this technology, at least what made it interesting to me, is that it was totally non-pharmaceutical. And so much of what's in the behavioral health and mental health space is psychopharma and medication management. And I'm certainly not an anti-pharma guy. I think that these are very useful evidence-based adjuncts that are available. But to be able to offer something that is completely non-pharmaceutical and non-surgical and a very gentle 30 minutes a day of treatment type of offering was pretty exciting to me. And
so typically, how many sessions does a person need to have a breakthrough, or where they can kind of stop coming in, or do they need to come back like once a month for refreshers?
Yeah. So our protocol is 30 minutes a day, generally 5 days a week. For our veterans, we typically see 4 to 6 weeks of treatments. They'll usually start noticing a benefit within the first week or two. And we're getting EEGs every week, every 2 weeks, so we can monitor progress. And I would say that's actually a fairly powerful tool, is just to be able to see that something is there. I think many of our vets have been told that, hey, your MRI is normal. This is just something that's in your head. Or what we found, and this is my firm belief, is that there tends to be very frequently an organic issue, whether it's in the circuitry or neuronal misfiring, that is leading to symptomatology. And many times, just to be able to understand that, and that it's not an issue of discipline or suck it up
or praying.
I mean, that, you know, there is something here, and we might be able to work to improve that. You know, in terms of the healing journey, I think that's an important first step, is to be able to see that, acknowledge it. And then, you know, I'm a big advocate just in terms of patient care and being transparent. We're one modality. I think we're a very powerful one, but there are many other things that I would endorse for most patients, whether it's meditation, mindfulness, proper eating, good exercise, but really, I think foundationally, one of the things that's become of critical importance is proper sleep. And it's an interesting phenomenon. A researcher out of Berkeley, formerly at Harvard, Matthew Walker, published a book called Why We Sleep. But he's highlighted that we're the only species in nature that will voluntarily self-deprive itself of sleep. It's such a critical element to our physiology. And, you know, we can talk for hours about the long-term and downrange, both benefits and detriments, if you're underslept, whether it's cardiovascular health, cerebrovascular health, emotional resilience, even proneness to injury. You know, there's these great studies now showing the importance of sleep. And with our treatment, we've actually noticed that there is one of the first things we hear is that people are getting deeper, higher quality sleep. And I wanted to test that for myself. So I got one of these Whoop devices. They're wearables where you can measure sleep. They're supposed to be roughly 90% as accurate as an in-lab polysomnogram. And I was pleasantly surprised. The amount of REM sleep I was getting did increase quite a bit. And so We're kind of learning about these things as we move forward. But yeah, you know, this is, I think we're entering an era where we want to, in the best interest of patient care, add adjunctively all the other things that are very good and beneficial for emotional well-being and overall health.
So if somebody who's listening wants to investigate this in their area, what would they look for? Neurofeedback?
So neurofeedback is a different type of modality.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the base technology, something called transcranial magnetic stimulation. You had mentioned that in the beginning.
Where it sends pulses.
Exactly. It's about 5 seconds of pulses every minute for 30 minutes. We're doing the same thing with the TMS device, except we're modifying it with a personalized protocol that is unique to each individual. And so getting the EEG is that first step. And if there was interest in, you know, evaluating it, looking into it, it's called MyWave TMS, and you can investigate it at braintreatmentcenter.com. That's our clinical group. There's a group of doctors, and they have clinics around the country. We're the technology company. I sit on the technology side of the house, part of an organization called Wave Neuroscience or WaveNeuro.com. And there's regulatory reasons where there has to be separation of church and state. And so the physician group that is practicing medicine cannot be incentivized to use the technology. They always have to do what's in the best interest of the patient. And so we separate our doctor group from our technology R&D. And that's why there's sort of two separate entities
here. No insider trading.
No.
You must have seen some horrifying stuff when you were on your tour of duty. Do you sometimes wonder whether or not you have PTSD?
Yeah, it's a great question. And one of the things I like to talk about, and sort of carrying the torch of General Corelli, who was pushing for the D to be taken out of post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress is a normal human reaction to this environment. And whether it's a veteran who experiences trauma in a combat environment or a sexual trauma survivor who experiences something horrific, the brain tends to rewire in a certain way that's, that's very difficult to overcome from time to time. And where, I think that there is academic discussion of disorders, how much does it impair you in your day-to-day life? And, for me, I've been able to push forward. I've certainly experienced and witnessed some not very pleasant things. But I've been able to manage for whatever reason. And so I've never really explored or sought help. But I do know there are times when I go through some significant feelings of guilt that I couldn't have done more for my brothers and sisters at the moment of need. I think that's part of being human. But I haven't found it to be disabling yet. But I think that that's an important part of the discussion is there is an amount I think everyone has internally of neuroplasticity. And so even when these horrible things happen, what we found is in certain individuals, areas of the brain that may not be firing well seem to get stuck. And that can be from physical trauma, from, let's just say, a blast injury. It can be from emotional trauma of losing a loved one. It can be from chemical trauma. If somebody's had years of hard drinking or hard drugs, we just find areas of the brain that are not firing as well as they should. Sometimes more than 2 standard deviations.
I got you.
And when we find that there's a very significant deviation from where you'd expect those neurons to be firing, those are the areas that we target with our transcranial magnetic stimulation device.
I got you.
And so, even though you'd mentioned you didn't have a positive response in the past, and you can take this off the air if you want, but I would love to get an EEG and have this conversation with you and see if you might have a response if we're able to customize it to you as an individual.
Where are you based?
So we're based out of Newport Beach in San Diego. I think you're in LA.
I am.
So we were planning on opening a center in LA. I don't know where we are with that, but just
Now would be a great time.
Okay. All right. Well, let's pick that up. Yeah. Let's pick that up offline. And I know you can edit things. So we can.
Yeah. No, I'm leaving all this in. It's all good stuff. Yeah.
All right. You know, I'm always sensitive to medical privacy, but yeah, you know, and I can't make any promises and don't want to, you know, embellish or oversell or any of that. But I do think that there's a chance that we could see a response that you didn't experience with the one size fits all version of TMS.
Oh, cool. I'd definitely be down for that. So shoot me an email if you guys do open up one in LA, or I'll just move to San Diego and start a life there.
There are worse places to be in the world than San Diego.
Yeah, my best friend lives down in Carlsbad. He's a retired MD. He was an interventional pain specialist. So we did an initial recording, and you did. Let's talk about what we said after the initial recording, the email, and then let's pick it up there.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, our discussion caused me to be fairly introspective in thinking about my experience with post-traumatic stress. And it really brought to mind, I think, the experience I went through in New York. And I didn't mention to you in our initial call that I had volunteered a month to go to New York City during the height of the pandemic there. And I volunteered at two locations. One was SUNY Hospital downstate, also referred to as University Hospital. And then within the first week or two, there was a recognition that a lot of the sickest people and the highest mortality was coming from the nursing homes. So I started spending time at one of the nursing homes in Cobble Hill. And for me, that was a fairly profoundly impactful experience. And you know, in our initial conversation, my mindset was really focused on the military. And, you know, I mentioned that, you know, a lot of the people who were experiencing trauma were on the front lines. And I, as a physician, was in the back taking care of the injuries and stitching people up and coordinating medevacs. But it was a different experience in New York in the sense that, first, it was an incredible privilege to serve alongside the people who had been there from the beginning. And the unique dynamic was that many of the physicians I got to serve with were there for 9/11. And so,
wow. These sort
of, you know, mass casualty events where you're dealing with a constant onslaught of morbidity and mortality really just takes a toll that I wasn't anticipating. And, I feel unworthy of complaining. I was only there for a month. The people who have been there for a very prolonged period of time. Just to frame this a little bit, especially in the nursing homes.
By the way, that's kind of like saying, you know, I only got hit by a car once. There's somebody I know that got hit by a car twice.
Well, yeah. And I suppose to a degree, all things are relative, but my heart really goes out to the people who have been in for the full marathon. And for me, 30 days was just soul crushing because, and I think of, you know, in these nursing homes, and this was actually a different time. We've gotten so much better at managing COVID-19, and we have new therapeutics that have come online like remdesivir and dexamethasone and monoclonal antibodies. Back then, it was a novel virus and we really didn't know how to effectively combat it. And just to explain, in the nursing homes, when one of the residents was going to expire, they didn't get to be with their loved ones. You know, we were connecting families by tablet and, you know, they would have to say their goodbyes remotely.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was pretty horrible. And that's one component. The other one is, some of the greatest, I would say, unsung heroes are, you know, the nurses and medical staff at these facilities. Just their fierce dedication to helping their patients and their communities was awe-inspiring. And I get emotional even talking about it now. But some of these ladies were, you know, they came from the Dominican Republic to serve, and they would not leave the bedside of some of these patients. And at the same time, there's tremendous fear for self, and going home to your families, you worried, am I giving this to, you know, my children or my spouse? And
or people that live with their grandparents, you know, or their parents. I can't imagine how stressful that must be. If you would paint a picture and give me some, if you can remember, specific examples to really kind of bring us there to be a fly on the wall.
Sure. And, you know, the experiences were very different too. I think in a hospital setting, many of the patients I had the privilege of taking care of were either put on ventilators or were in the units. And so, and there was a large team to take care of them. And so the difficulty there was that there's fairly rapid turnover. There were a lot of patients, unfortunately, who we couldn't save. But in the nursing homes where you got to know many of the patients and the residents, that for me on a human level was a bit more challenging. And I think back fondly to a wonderful lady who was struggling with dementia, and she would tell me the same beautiful story every day that I saw her, as if it was the first time of when she met her husband. And with the same enthusiasm and exuberance every day, for about 2.5 weeks, and then she had a very rapid decline. And for her family to not be able to be there, we weren't allowing family to come into the nursing homes, was really just torture to see. You know, it's not the right way for somebody who lived a full life and that was surrounded by love to not have, you know, the warm embrace of their children or grandchildren. To this day, it's a really hard thing. No, I apologize.
If there's any podcast where tears are welcomed, it's this one. It's one of the reasons why I started the podcast, because holding my tears in almost killed me. So,
yeah, no, these are just hard things to, I think, deal with. And, you know, of course, you know, my relationship with this incredible lady was 2.5 weeks. And so I think about the families who, you know, had to say their farewell. And, you know, that's, I'm sure, a lot to deal with. And so, yeah, it's a, I think, kind of a unique time. It's not something that we've had to deal with, I think, in our lifetimes. And so, you know, in terms of a message that I think would be useful to get out there, is just awareness of the first responder fatigue and in many cases, I think, post-traumatic stress that occurs. And not just doctors and nurses, but paramedics, firefighters, police officers, everyone who's interfacing with this sort of razor's edge of, you know, life and death and sickness, there's a human struggle behind all of that. And so I just think in this time, it's sort of been glossed over, but to hold the line in that time of just incredible crisis was amazing. And I think there are countless stories of heroism, and not just in New York, but we had reached very close to a breaking point, I believe, in Houston and Miami and Los Angeles as well. And so the teams that have been out there, I suspect there are people struggling, and I hope that they will reach out and seek help if they need it. Because this is, I believe, sort of this hidden epidemic within the pandemic, and people need to take care of themselves and need to get the rest they need to continue the fight.
Two questions. The first one is, I'm curious to know what the story is that woman told you. And then I'd like you to talk about the ways that PTSD is presenting itself, not only in you, but among other people that are on the front lines.
Yeah, well, so she would describe in great detail how, you know, she was just in a park and they had actually met in Europe, in France. And she could detail sort of the weather and how, you know, the flowers were blooming on that day. And, you know, her and her future husband just went for a walk in the park. And it was fascinating for me to hear kind of the same story and the facial expressions that she had. And for me, it was just a nice break. I kind of knew what was coming, but it was, you know, it was something I genuinely enjoyed to be able to relive that moment with her. And, but I couldn't have anticipated that, you know, just a couple of weeks later, she would be lost to the world.
By the way, it's nice too for somebody who's repeating a story when they have dementia for it to be a positive one. My grandmother repeatedly told the story about her mother and her mother collapsing and dying in front of her at church when she was seven. And oh boy, just hearing that story over and over again was you know, not pleasant. And of course, I felt for her because she had to keep reliving it. But go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, I'm sorry to hear that. I know that had to have been difficult.
I'm dead inside, so it didn't bother me, but go ahead.
In terms of how it's experienced, you know, everyone's just a little bit different. You know, for me, it was just, I found that I had less patience than I normally did. And, I don't know that it would be outwardly manifested other than I felt I had sort of lower energy than usual. And, you know, in reality, it may have just been a bit of a grieving process that, you know, we were part of kind of this historical event. I think very few people will have experienced that amount of mortality in a short kind of compressed period of time.
How many people do you think you were there when they passed away?
In person, it's a smaller number. I probably estimate about a dozen, but there would be people.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. But, you know, you think about the New York experience. It was, you know, tens of thousands of lives lost. And, you know, but our teams, you know, when we would do the handoffs and you finished rounds, you know, the next day, many of the people that you were taking care of weren't there anymore. And so it unfortunately kind of becomes something that you emotionally become numb to, and you just keep pressing forward because there's many other people who you need to take care of.
When somebody was put on a ventilator, did you generally think to yourself, this person's not going to make it?
I did not. You know, I think always... As a provider, you have to have hope and you exhaust every resource at your disposal. And so I didn't personally think that, you know, there was no chance or anything along those lines. You always go through a bit of a risk analysis. If somebody had diabetes and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and kidney disease, you know, the odds were stacked against them, and you would sort of wait, what are the chances of survival? I don't know that you would want to enter sort of discussion thinking that, yeah, this is a hopeless cause or anything like that. And so you always went into it with hopefully the right mindset and hope that, you know, we could save this individual.
How many people did you not necessarily accompany when they passed away, but people whose names you knew, who you had had a conversation with? Or is that the dozen you were speaking of?
Yeah, I would say that's the dozen I was speaking of. Probably larger numbers that would expire sort of when I was off shift and I'd come back the next day and you'd come to an empty room or a new name that was filling the bed. And so I think in that sense, the, for lack of a better term, the turnover rate was fairly substantial. That's, I think, obviously it's something that makes you very sad. But at the same time, I think you're forced to compartmentalize that and to try to keep press, you know, you keep pressing forward because there's other people who you need to take care of. And I suspect that's part of the difficulty. And while I was there, one of the, I think, real heroes of that time, her name was Dr. Lorna Brain. And she unfortunately committed suicide. This was something that was, you know, widely, unfortunately, was kind of widely discussed and was on the front page of the New York Times because she individually had saved hundreds of lives. And I think it just took a toll. And one of the other doctors I had the enormous privilege of working next to, his name was James Mahoney. He was a pulmonologist who put off retirement to be in the fight and to help at University Hospital. And he ended up not surviving himself. And so it's not just the patient care. I think that it's also...
From COVID?
Know, from COVID, yeah. You know, it's also sort of the pull that it takes on, you know, your own colleagues and teammates that can sort of compound, I think, the experience. So yeah, I'm hoping, you know, with the future trajectory of this, we've gotten so much smarter about how to treat and to manage. And the amount of protective gear that we have, I think, is in a much better place. So God willing, there won't be a similar episode where we're kind of caught off guard and trying to rally. But, you know, this being a really, it's looking like this is going to be kind of a long-term battle. I hope that if there are those who are struggling, that, you know, they will have the courage to reach out for help and to talk to their friends and colleagues about what's going on. I think awareness is one of the first issues that we need to deal with.
Anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
No, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about it. And yeah, I really appreciate all that you're doing for the community, your audience and listeners.
From the danger of my bedroom.
There you go.
I really appreciate you going back into those experiences and dredging them up so you could share them with us. And of course, thanks for your service. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure.
Many, many thanks to him. Somebody told me that the donation page for our website was down. I don't know how long it was down for, but anybody who went there with the intention of donating that couldn't, would love it if you went back and donated. You can do a one-time donation through PayPal or a monthly donation through either PayPal or Patreon. And I recommend Patreon because you can occasionally qualify for a little bonus stuff that I do. You can support the show non-financially by going to iTunes, giving us a good rating. And the best way, non-financially, you can support us is to subscribe. I always forget to mention, too, that there are t-shirts and coffee mugs and other stuff for sale on the website.
This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Let's jump into some surveys. I don't think I'm going to get through all of these. I always bite off more than I can chew. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself, "I thought I would take this to my grave." She's never been sexually abused. She writes that she's never been physically or emotionally abused. Darkest thoughts. Oh, she is identifies as straight, in her 20s, was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. Darkest thoughts. I'll share this another time. Darkest secrets. When I was in middle school, I masturbated with the electric toothbrushes of two of my relatives as I was curious about masturbation and did not have one myself. I do not know what the fuck compelled me to do such a disgusting and unhygienic thing. Afterwards, I felt guilty and tried my best to clean them in boiling water. I should have made up a story like I accidentally knocked them into the toilet and thrown them away. But no, I put them back in the cupboard. And even worse, I used them 3 or 4 more times. I am so fucking disgusted with myself because not only is this a horrible thing to do to anyone, my family is very strict about hygiene. Instead of sharing a tube of toothpaste, each of us have our own to minimize germs. Each toothbrush is kept in a different shelf so they don't accidentally brush against each other. So this is especially egregious. Ugh, I am the worst. Every once in a while, I come across a survey that... where the person did something so innocuous and clearly childlike when they were a child, and they're still holding it onto it today. Actually, more than occasionally I come across this, but this is something, in my opinion, that you laugh with friends about to this day. It's so human what you did. And boy, is it time to forgive yourself and move on and have some compassion for that curious kid. And by the way, this was filled out before COVID, so having the separate toothpastes thing. Have you shared these things with others? No, my family would be disgusted with me. I'm not saying you should share it with your family, but how do you feel after writing these things down? Bad, bad, bad. Oh, just want to give you a hug. Just want to give you a hug. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Ronan. He identifies as straight. He's in his 40s, was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. He writes that he's never been sexually abused, but he's been physically and emotionally abused. Mom's boyfriend repeatedly hit me. Stepdad was emotionally abusive. My personality is such that I get picked on constantly. Any positive experiences with abusers? He was otherwise a good dad, other than the hitting. Darkest thoughts. I am out of gas, emotionally and physically. I don't know what to do. Dying seems like the best option. Although if I had a friend or some way to support my family, I'd feel a lot better. Also, my wife recently confessed to multiple cheating early in our marriage. I'm conflicted sexually, but one thing I know for a fact is I don't love her like I used to. Darkest secrets, cheating wife. I get excited thinking about her with another guy, but in reality, I'd probably beat him badly. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you, watching my wife with another guy or girl, mostly guys, and I suck them after they use my wife. Then I fuck my wife when she is all full of his semen. I'm completely depressed about this situation. This is not me. At least I didn't think so. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Honestly, I want my wife to understand what she did to me. She still doesn't get it. What, if anything, do you wish for? I don't want to be who I am. I'm miserable.
Have you shared these things with others? No, I'm afraid if I tell anyone, it will make it worse. How do you feel after writing these things down? Scared. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? I don't know. Oh, buddy. I'm sorry that you're struggling and you're in pain. And just let me assure you that there are many, many people who have that cheating fantasy. I have friends who have that one. And you would think, isn't that in conflict with their fear of their partner actually cheating? And it's actually one of the ways that our brain deals with our anxiety about things. We sexualize them unconsciously and without our consent. Our bodies and our brains are turned on by certain things. So that is no statement on your morality or any of that stuff. But you know, to me, one of the hallmarks of intimacy in a relationship is a willingness to have difficult conversations. And I think it would at least give your relationship a chance of improving if you didn't just sweep under the rug the things that you're still feeling. And it might be good to do it with a therapist to kind of mediate it. So sending you some love, man. And speaking of loves, is from the love survey filled out by somebody who just filled out a bunch of numbers as their name. I love a poop so good that it makes you wish you'd weighed yourself before and after. The kind that makes you go, fuck, that was a good poop. I love that my cat can tell when I need love and when I want to be left alone. When they can tell I need love, they cuddle up to me and lay on me, any way to get as close to me as they can. I love the satisfaction of completing a ridiculously difficult jigsaw puzzle. I love the exact moment when this particular adorable dog in my neighborhood recognizes me and his limbs pull four different directions out of excitement to get to me. I love when the last bite of something is the best bite. Wow, you don't have the sadness that I do when the last bite. It's very rare the last bite coincides with feeling satisfied. I love my vibrator. Seriously, I now question whether I ever had an orgasm before I got this amazing thing. I love the random things my nephews and niece call me before they can say my actual name. I love a man's natural smell. Not BO, not cologne, not deodorant, just a natural scent. Few things turn me on more. I love the breakthroughs I've made in the last few years as I've fought mental health and self-hatred demons. Contrary to what I thought for nearly 30 years, I love myself and my body. Oh, that is such a great one. Thank you. Those are awesome. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Anne. She identifies as straight, in her 30s. Raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment, never been sexually abused, never been physically or emotionally abused. Darkest thoughts, I love my husband so much, I could see myself killing a rival for his affection. Darkest secrets, I cheated on my first husband. He was abusive and tried to, quote, get the truth out of me, but that doesn't make it okay. I've never told anyone that. We are divorced now and I remarried, but I still carry that with me. In a bad, bad way. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. I think about my husband with other women, and that gets me off. Or the idea of being gang-fucked, but not the realness of it. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I'd tell my 15-year-old daughter all of the reasons that she should wait for sex, drugs, and alcohol. How much can I reveal before I turn into an advertisement? What do you wish for, if anything, for my father to live forever? Have you shared these things with others? No. How do you feel after writing these things down? Better. Thanks, Paul. Thank you for that. And, you know, this was filled out right next to the other survey about the guy who was turned on by the idea of his wife cheating, even though in reality it's his one of his worst fears. And I love when there's that
those nice coincidences. It almost feels like the universe is telling people, you are not alone in this, and this is not as abnormal as you think it is. Our brains react to abnormal situations in ways that are baffling to us, but to heap judgment on ourselves is not helpful. This is a happy moment filled out by a guy who calls himself, I don't smile much, but my kids help me even though I don't want to have them, and they will never know that. He writes, doing a school-assigned exercise class with my son I'm going to hold back the name of it just in case for some reason his kids would hear that. I don't know, maybe I'm being codependent. His mother and I are no longer together, so he spends part of his day with me and the other half with his mother. We watch the live broadcasts on YouTube in the living room. We move the coffee table and spread out and fully participated, being goofballs and letting ourselves be kids. He was so excited and full of joy and enthusiasm for it. The host would say, turn to someone in your house and tell them, you got this. And my son would turn and look at me with so much enthusiasm in his eyes and yell at me, Dad, you got this. He's happy to do anything with me, especially if I smile. I smiled that day a lot. God, do I love that. God, do I love when you see kids and they feel safe and connected and seen. That is the best gift you can give them. This is a shame and secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Jerk Off Boy 69. I believe that's his legal name. He identifies as bisexual. He's in his 20s, was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. My mom was always super handsy and close with us. She used to share way too much weird shit, too. Once my older sister ran into the room shouting for me. She said, come look at this. I ran off with her. She took me to the toilet where my mom sat with her tampon string hanging out of her. She just sat there and let us look at it like it was a funny joke. What the fuck, mom? That's fucking weird. Have some boundaries. Jesus. She also told me she wanted to watch porn with me, sort of as a joke, question mark. That is sexual abuse. There is no doubt about this. This is what's called covert incest, and there is a great book by a guy named Dr. Kenneth Adams. It's called Silently Seduced, and if you're listening, I highly recommend you read that, or anybody who's hearing this and is relating. It's sadly all too common, the way that you describe your mother violating your boundaries. And it's every bit as damaging as actual physical contact. But it was years ago, and I still remember it being super weird. But I've never talked to her about it, and it's fucking up my relationships and sex life now. I get grossed out by intimacy and often feel like I'm losing control of my body when other people initiate anything sexual. It's confusing, and I have a lot of rage about it, but it's all locked away. I feel a lot of shame about having step-sibling fetishes, and sometimes I watch mother-son role-play porn, which really turns me on but makes me feel sick and ashamed. I'm starting to remember some other possible abuse, too, with an older man. I think when I was a little boy, I'm sure something happened, and I'm starting to have weird body reactions and shaking uncontrollably the more I remember. It's driving me mad not knowing what happened. Sometimes I think I'm making things up in my head. It's hard to trust my feelings. I don't want to talk about it. I highly, highly recommend talking to a therapist about this. Going to a support group for intimacy struggles would be another great thing. If you're hearing this and you relate, you can contact me through the website. I have some suggestions.
EMDR might be a good thing, because clearly, you know, the way your body is reacting. Again, I'm not a therapist, but I have done a lot of different types of therapy and healing from the covert incest I experienced as a kid. And I'm so glad it gave me my life back. And it allowed me to experience intimacy. And it feels fucking great being able to experience intimacy. He's not sure if he's ever been physically or emotionally abused. He writes, "My dad is controlling. He's super defensive and very insecure. I think his parents never showed much affection to him, and his dad was very critical of him all the time. As a result, my dad runs the family like it's his own personal stage show. We all have set scripts. No one can point out that everything feels fake and tense. He was very mean and belittling to all of us. I always felt he knew everything, and I was stupid and incompetent. I never felt it was okay to just be me, a young boy, a child. I have to be perfect and mature and polite and sensible. And I don't know if this is emotional abuse." Yes, it is emotional abuse. "But I think it's given me a lot of anxiety and fear about speaking my mind and having my own feelings and needs." And of course, being raised in an environment like that would make intimacy terrifying. It's your brain trying to protect yourself because it doesn't know that there are other people out there that aren't your parents, that are safe. Any positive experiences with the abusers? Yes, definitely. My parents loved spending time with us, even if it was sort of for their pleasure. We had a lot of cool holidays. My dad spent lots of time making up games for us, building tree houses, telling us stories, taking us on treasure hunts. It's confusing because he put a lot of effort and time into these nice things, but it didn't change how I felt about him. It makes me feel unappreciative, and I doubt my own feelings of anger towards my parents now. Whenever I bring it up, my dad makes the point he wanted to be the best dad ever, and I don't really know just how much time and money and effort my parents put into us kids. You know, your feelings are your feelings, and if they aren't the same feelings and perspective your father had, that's okay. You don't need his permission to validate your feelings and experiences, and that's why I think therapy would be, and support groups would be so great. Darkest thoughts. "Sometimes I find myself thinking about what it would be like to just lose it and beat the shit out of someone, stab someone, and just let out all my rage. I'd never act on it, though. I find myself pissed off by all my friends sometimes, like it's all just an act, and they don't know that I'm really an asshole who just plays nice to be around people. Makes me feel like a sociopath or something. Also, I'm turned on by incest porn. I feel like a broken, perverted loser because of that. But then I see it's one of the top trending categories for the United States. Maybe everyone is a little fucked up like me? ?" I've sometimes looked at role-playing incest porn and pleasured myself to it. Boy, that feels uncomfortable to say that out loud. But I just want to let you know that you're not alone. And the interesting thing was, it was really a turn-on to me when I was in the early state. First of all, for the first, 90% of my life, it was never anything that turned me on. Then when the reality of what hit me with my mom, and I started remembering a lot of the things, that was the thing that I went to soothe myself sexually. And then as I began to heal, I lost interest in it. And that to me is proof that there is a correlation between trauma and stuff that turns us on, for some of us. Darkest secrets. "I think I maybe did some sexual stuff with my little sister when I was younger. I struggle to remember, but I have a feeling I'd persuade her to show me her genitals or we'd play pretend having sex? I've never been in a relationship. I guess I have an all-around feeling that my real life is embarrassing and dirty and broken. So I've learned to play by the rules and sort of live with and through other people, neglecting my own black tar of a life that I keep in my belly, feeding it with Ben and Jerry's and mommy porn." Oh, buddy. Oh. Oh, by the way, Ben and Jerry's does have a new flavor, and it's called mommy porn. Interesting. Interestingly enough, it's banana ice cream with fudge hands and a penis core. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. Oops, already sort of covered this. Role play incest porn really does it for me. Brother and sister and mom and son. I feel worried that people would find out and reject me. Sharing it makes me feel a little less scary. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? Mom, I'm not your little toy to play with and use to cover up your own sex and relationship issues. I don't owe you, and it's not my job to make you feel better. You were inappropriate a lot when I was young, and it's fucked me up, and that's why I'm seeing less of you these days. Stop making me feel guilty about it. I haven't said this because I feel mean and don't want to hurt my mom's feelings. And that is the hurdle to your healing, is you valuing yourself above your mother's feelings in terms of processing this. And she doesn't even have to know any of this, but it's time to validate the feelings you have instead of you criticizing yourself for having these feelings. You know, I can tell you all of the feelings that you're having are totally in line with somebody who experienced what you experienced. What, if anything, do you wish for? A healthy relationship with someone I can be myself around, and we can both heal together and be there for each other. I really, really recommend that you work on healing yourself before you get into a serious relationship with somebody, because the most common thing that happens is we use them to try to fix us, and then we just get into a spiral of codependency and trauma bonding. And I know that because I have done that. Have you shared these things with others? Most of them with my therapist. It felt good to get it off my chest, but my therapist didn't give me much back. I still feel I lack the tools to work through these issues when I'm not in the therapist's room. I should have read that before I suggested therapy. Sorry about that. But support groups. How do you feel after writing these things down? I feel like I'm being more honest with myself about how bad some of my issues are. I feel more open and more accepting of myself. I feel sad. And that's one of the signs of recovery, is sadness, mourning the life, the innocent childhood that we didn't get to have. You know, sadness and anger and confusion, those are all overwhelming, inescapable feelings associated with healing and recovery, but it is better to get through them and let those feelings process than to be dragged down by them and to feel alone and small and hopeless the rest of our lives. Is there anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Isn't it fucked? I know how it feels. It's not your fault. You're not a pervert sex freak. You're actually a pretty fun and interesting person. Don't be ashamed of your story and things that were beyond your control. Let's go bowling and talk about it. Oh, man. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Very much related to that one. You are not alone. And then this is our final survey. This is a happy moment filled out by Willow. And she writes, as a teen and as an adult, I had quite an array of hobbies and have always been a big DIYer. My senior year of high school, I bought a plain black evening gown at a thrift store, and I did some really cool bead work on it to wear to homecoming. I was sexually assaulted in college, and afterward, it felt like everything about my life before then belonged to someone else. The academic awards, the eclectic bookshelf, the totes of craft supplies and unfinished DIY projects, the varsity letters, etc. It wasn't until my late 20s that I stopped feeling like all of that was someone else's existence. This past summer, I was at my childhood home and stumbled across that black dress in the back of my old closet. I've gotten back into beadwork as of late, and holding that dress in my hand cemented it in my head. Yes. That was you. You are still the same person, and what happened all those years ago does not change that. Love it. Love it. Thank you for that. If you're out there and you're feeling stuck, I'm sending you love and good vibes, and you are so not alone. You are so not alone. It's such a shitty thing our brains tell us. You know,
It is one of the biggest wastes of time in our life is listening to the mean part in our brain, but sometimes it's so hard to separate what is reality from what is our brain trying to protect ourselves. But if you're out there and you're struggling, you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some
is
weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully everybody fucked up in some weird way. Bizarrely.